Eugenio, thank you for coming in. You have such a amazing background. You're still relatively quite young. I mean, for somebody who's been around for like 70 years, right? So, and it's quite remarkable the accomplishments you have. So, thank you for coming in and sharing your insights with our audience.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So, Eugenio, one of the things that my audience is always curious about is you have so much success in such a early age and throughout your entire career, and then you got so much more to go. So what were some of the inflection points? And maybe it was something that happened when you were five, or maybe it was in school, a mentor, could be someone in your family, maybe career choices that happened, but really things that were change makers in your life that created this remarkable success history that you have.
Well, first of all, thank you for the kind words. I would say that something that definitely helped me was relatively early in my career and my life, I understood the power of people. I studied engineering. I'm an engineer by training. And I quickly realized how sometimes us as engineers and people in technology sometimes maybe forget a bit the human component. We focus a bit too much on some of the technicalities, the data, the technology, because it's fascinating, because it's a beautiful, endeavor. It's something that can really do a lot. But sometimes it's a bit misleading. Sometimes we forget that technology has to have a purpose. So I would say that early on in my career, probably between college and grad school, I started understanding the power of people, the power of connecting with people, the power of networking. And just in general, listening to what people need. And usually that's something that is very helpful for, obviously the others that can feel heard, that can feel that their issues are understood, but also for us, and especially for me, because I can learn a lot about what's needed in the industry, what are some of the pain points, and then find ways to address that. So putting people before has probably been my mantra so far.
So what I'm hearing is that, and I know this too, is you can be very technically oriented and have a great background experience from a technical standpoint, but you really need to know how to engage with people, because ultimately it's people, right? And in fact, I used to teach many, many years ago. I used to teach computing technology, computing science. I used to teach mathematics, and then also business. And especially amongst my computing students, I always found that there was this kind of gap on the people side. There was you're absolutely right. You have to have this sort of engagement networks and so on, and you clearly show that. And you indicated you studied engineering. So tell me what that experience was like when you studied engineering.
Yeah, so I studied engineering in Italy, which is also slightly different from other countries. It's a pretty theoretical experience in Italy in undergrad. You learn most of the basics, and we in particular learn a lot about both software, electronic engineering, so both software and hardware. So a very good horizontal understanding of everything that's technology, from building a computer to writing code. And so it was really helpful to gain a foundation in exactly what you said, which is technology and the power of technology. But to some extent, it was a bit oriented more towards the basics, towards 1970s, 1980s, the beginning of transistor, CMOS, computers, and computer programming. So to some extent, we gained a lot in understanding the foundation, but we lost a bit in everything that is. To some extent, the skills that are in demand and were in demand at that point in time. And I'll say that still ties a bit to the concept of, putting people first. Like, we definitely learned the basics of technology, but we didn't know what people needed, what employers needed. And so that created a bit of a gap that then we had to, overcome, so to say. And I'll say also, doing so much technology at the beginning, doing so much engineering was great, but sometimes we and especially realized how the people component was not put first. We were doing technology because we really liked it. We really liked to, create software, create code that was clever, that was almost you know, a sign of something that we can do, but it was solving no problem at all. And so I then moved more towards, you know, bioengineering, healthcare engineering, to try and bridge that gap. So to try and use technology for a purpose.
You know, that's really interesting. And I can, again, see this sort of thread of, you know, people first and having this practical aspect of solutions that are purposeful and have some kind of impact. And I can see that throughout your career. You went to different schools, though. You went to schools in Italy, and then you went to MIT and Harvard and the U.S. and then Imperial College in London. You know, what are the differences? You know, what are the advantages of each one of those different milestones in your life from an educational standpoint? What do you think are the strengths of the Italian education versus the MIT Harvard education versus the Imperial College? Because they're different, right? There's similarities, yeah. But there's got to be differences.
Yeah, that's a great question. There are quite a few differences, I'd say. First of all, something like an Italian education tends to be a bit more theoretical, has a great advantage in the sense that it teaches you a lot of the basics, a lot of the theory, and you get to better understand why things are done this way. And this obviously creates some sort of, you know, culture, which tends to be a bit more horizontal, which allows you to then draw on a lot of different, you know, parts, also maybe, you know, not too technical concepts, but it also teaches you things which probably not too relevant. The first thing that we learned was to read binary code. So right now I can read binary code, I can write binary code, but it's not the most useful skill in the job market. And so you can see in the UK and even more in the US, universities are slightly less theoretical, which of course has its pros and cons, but definitely has a lot of pros on setting people up for success in the work environment. And I've seen a lot more joint effort, so to say, between academia and companies in trying to craft a curriculum in universities that was setting students up for success, trying to make them learn the skills that are needed. So maybe instead of learning assembly or binary code like I did, we were learning at MIT Python, R, and that was fantastic because for data scientists and for a lot of people in technology, those are the things to do. So a few pros and cons. I tend to personally prefer a more pragmatic approach that allows you to understand also what's going to be a real life situation and not just in theory.
So let's drill down further. So I can clearly see now the difference between Italian education and then the MIT, Harvard, and Imperial College. So what are the differences between MIT and Harvard, and then MIT and Harvard versus Imperial College, right? So
I would say probably MIT and Harvard tend to be even more so oriented towards the, you know, pragmatic applications of education. And there is especially a strong focus on career development. So I've seen a lot of benefits in having conversation within the master's, within the programs there, with the career development officers there. So in trying to learn how to better position yourself in the job market as a competitive applicant. So a lot of things about networking, about, you know, being thoughtful in the way that we interact with recruiters and so on. So very strong focus on the recruitment process and how to be successful in the work environment, in the job applications. Well, in the UK, it is definitely very oriented towards the job application process as well, but maybe not as much as in the US. While it holds still a bit of the, you know, theoretical aspects and the research aspects. So definitely a few differences there as well.
And then lastly, between MIT and Harvard, because they're not the same school, so there's a different culture. Describe how they're different.
They're definitely not, yeah. I found probably Harvard to be obviously more classical, as someone might expect, in the sense that the pace there, I also find the pace slightly more balanced at Harvard. It's neither good nor bad, but I definitely found the ability to, you know, digest information more attainable at Harvard. So more of a focus on maybe thinking a bit slower, but also being able to understand the concepts further. While MIT fast-paced environment, which has, again, its pros and cons. And MIT, we tend to say it's like drinking from a fire hose. So it's so much information. And so obviously it sets you up for success later on in life because you are trained, you know, with the best, and you are in a situation where there's a lot of mathematical concepts very fast. So obviously much more technical and a lot of information at once.
So that's a quite a spectrum, right? Sort of very traditional learning binary code. And I used to do binary code as well on a similar site. So I fully comprehend. And in fact, I used to teach some of that too. So I can see this sort of very, very old school way, very broad. And then you talk about MIT also be more practical, but so much information thrown at you, right? And Harvard's a little bit more balanced, as you say, and more kind of even, and perhaps a little bit more stylistic, like classical. And then Imperial would also be somewhere in between, right? More perhaps more classical. But you indicated there's this differentiation with MIT, Harvard, and Imperial, right? More practical than the Italian education. So, you know, that's useful for the audience. Yeah, they'll know, you know, your background, but that would also make you stronger, wouldn't it? To have these different schools, the different experiences, it'll help you think in oblique ways better than if you just had one style of education.
Yeah, absolutely. And going back to what you were saying at the beginning, of some of the successes, so to say, I've had also come from this ability to adapt to different environments. So being able to understand that each university, each job, each work environment is a challenge in itself, and it has its own rules, its own, it's almost as if it was a game in itself that you have to learn the rules first and then be able to master those rules. So say, you know, in Italy it was a bit more about memorizing, learning a lot of theoretical information and understanding the value there of this culture. And maybe, you know, at MIT it was a bit more about understanding the power of joining some events where there were potential employers and being thoughtful, you know, in the way that maybe we send thank you notes to those people. So a lot of benefits, but also come from this ability to adapt and to understand that you have to be very flexible in the way you approach all these different things.
And the education in Italy is provided by the government, from what I understand. Isn't it free?
It depends. Yeah, it's much more free than in the US for sure. So the cost of tuition in the US is orders of magnitude higher than in Italy. So you might be able to, with $1,000 or even nothing, if like me, you don't come from a very wealthy background, to be able to go for university without having to spend a cent. And that's one of the big differences as well between, you know, Italy, the UK, and the US. In Italy, is much more of a benefit provided by government, or at least incentivized by the government, while in the US, a bit more of a business with its pros and cons.
Now, you became a Forbes under 30. How did that happen, do you think?
I would say because, again, I've always been trying to put people first and to try and understand how to basically start from there, start from the people, and then come up with good technology that answer people's questions. And one of the examples was during the COVID-19 pandemic at MIT. I was there between 2019 and 2020. So in March 2020, we definitely had a huge shock. We were, you know, by ourselves in campus. We, out of the blue, had to, you know, completely change how we approach life and how also we approach studies. And I helped co-found this task force there that tried to use analytics and data science, which is what we were studying. So together with professors and researchers at MIT mostly, we tried to go online, you know, with automatic processes, with web scraping, to try and gather all of this data, all of this information into one single data set, containing information on hospitalizations and, you know, everything else that might be related to COVID-19 infections. And we then trained models that were able to predict across the country where some of these hot pockets of areas of infection might have been in a few weeks' time. And in this way, we would have been able to provide insights to some of the key stakeholders there, like governments, the White House, and so on, where to direct personnel, PPE, masks, and so on, before these areas actually became hotspots for COVID. And we actually ended up speaking with a lot of government officials, with a lot of folks, to try and direct the right resources that were very limited in the right areas. So I would say definitely that helped, is probably one of the key reasons why I had the honor to be in Forbes list. But it's especially because we tried to do something which made sense and which helped people, and then use technology to basically do that.
So that's really interesting. And while you're at MIT, you actually developed this data analytics system. You did, you collected data from different sources, and you were able to apply that to train models so that you can do predictive analysis or predictive indicators of where the pandemic was going to concentrate or build and so on. And that could be of use to White House and CEOs and other leading research institutions. And because you took that leadership role in doing this and applying your knowledge, and you would actually have to code as well, you then got this recognition as Forbes Under 30. So did you also then become the World Economic Forum Global Shaper from that work? Did that sort of relate it to that work?
To some extent, yeah. It's this passion of the work with the World Economic Forum is more of, let's say, I wouldn't call it charity work, but it's definitely more volunteer-focused work. So trying to put together our skills, less on the technical side with the World Economic Forum, but still more about connecting with people, connecting with stakeholders across governments and companies to try and find ways to meet the social development goals and sustainability development goals of the United Nations. So definitely that experience from working with White House officials, government officials, and so on helped a lot and still helps a lot, because it was one of those situations where you can clearly see how you might come from MIT, you might be a very technical person, but you really have to understand that not everyone is like that. Not everyone is speaking the same language as you, and we might not think about what you do or the way you think is the usual one. It's not the usual one for them. So a lot of learning how to communicate with non-technical stakeholders, non-technical people, and especially people in the government that have big issues, not much time, and they want to better understand what policies to make or just what decisions to take. And that definitely applies both to the experience with COVID-19 and that task force, as well as now with the World Economic Forum.
Yeah, I mean, I can see how all of this outreach and volunteer work you've done and taking leadership has then sort of built on each other. And then it leads to things like being involved in the World Economic Forum as a global shaper. You get this Forbes Under 30, which gives you TED speaking engagements. You're a contributor to Harvard Business Review, Forbes, Fortune, as well as different journals. This will then result in awards. And there's this confluence of all of these activities that sort of help to amplify what you're doing. You then got into CVS Health, which is actually the world's largest health company. And I didn't know that, by the way. When I was, I actually asked Bing AI to say, tell me something about CVS Health. And you're like a Fortune 5 company or something. You're in the, even in the global rankings, you're amongst the top in revenue and size and clinics. And I checked with one of my partners and I said, I met this gentleman named Eugenio, and he's a data science leader at CVC Health. CVC Health, yeah, they're really good. He says, very impact driven, very thoughtful in terms of your that work. So you're integrated into that ecosystem of CVS Health. So how did you get hired? And then describe your career journey in CVS Health, where you're now a data science leader.
Yeah, so I definitely got approached while at MIT, so towards the end, I'd say that all of the experience working in AI for healthcare has definitely helped, because that's what you, as you said, that's what we do. So we focus a lot on data, on data science and AI to try and make a positive impact on society. And that's one of the things that I like the most. So be able to align both the financial incentives, the ability of being a business, making a profit, with the ability to make an impact on society and on people's health. And I'd say one of the most beautiful things about CVS is this ability to align both the components, the financial component and the positive impact component. And it's not usually the case with most. And my trajectory so far in the company has been a relatively classic one, so to say, in the sense that I started as a data scientist. So very hands-on, coding machine learning pipelines, trying to make predictive models and so on. And I then became more senior in that position, and now I'm a manager. So my role is more of a player and coach type of situation. So I obviously still code, but much less than I used to. And I find a lot of joy actually in managing people, in leading people, in trying to better understand how not just to do something, but how to convey that information and basically try to replicate what I can do in many more ways and try to be an effective leader that way.
And in your role as data science leader at CVS Health, you're also involved in innovation. Can you describe what that means to the audience?
Yeah, definitely. Like a big component that especially my team is trying to innovate and find new ways to create products, machine learning products usually, that can help people. So it's not just about fixing bugs, developing features, but it's trying to come up with new products that can help people in innovative ways, in new creative ways. And what this means is simply that sometimes, like in most of the data science pipelines, you might start with analyzing data and trying to understand what are some potential opportunities or big issues across the country. So there might be some diseases that might be really relevant in the US that might be affecting a lot of people, and they might also have a huge impact, not just on their health, but also on their financial situation. And so the innovative ways to come up with products sometimes is just about using this data to come up with decisions, so a lot of data-driven decision making, and then thinking about how can we address this disease, so to say, to improve the situation, the condition of people through machine learning. So it's a lot of coming up with concepts of machine learning pipelines that can provide insights to us internally and then to the actual people, to the actual members of our community, to improve our health and also save a lot of money by avoiding hospitalizations. So that's pretty much what we try and do.
You're a data scientist and you're in machine learning and AI, and you won all of these awards, like the McCarthy Award, John McCarthy Award for contributions to AI, the Nova Talent of the Year Award, the ISPI BCG Featured Leaders Award. And we talked earlier, you've been featured in Forbes, Fortune, HBR, Washington Post, Bloomberg, Financial Times, and so on. And in fact, I'm interviewing you because of the nature of your work, and it's so profound and has so much impact. Taking all of that into consideration, then you'd have a pretty good lens of what are the emerging areas that people need to pay attention to. So first of all, because you are a data scientist and you're in machine learning AI, what are some really exciting areas and how are you involved in those exciting areas, and where do you think that they're going to go?
So I would definitely say artificial intelligence is one of those. but again, it has to be used in ways that can be, you know, sensible and meaningful for the people that are going to be impacted by AI. And I think that's one of the issues sometimes, is when we have tools as powerful as ChatGPT or all of the other large language models, the question is not anymore about what we can do or, you know, how can we make better models, but rather how can we use the tools that we have to make a positive impact without, you know, affecting negatively all of this population because of the power of these tools. And I think especially in the healthcare domain, we're going to see a lot of benefits from the artificial intelligence tools and capabilities that we're experiencing. And I tend to think of this as three different pillars, the three P, as I call them. So predictions, personalization, and paperwork. So some of the big issues in healthcare pretty much revolve around these three different pillars. The first one of them is the fact that if we think about medicine, it's more about curing a disease, but sometimes that's already too late. Obviously, none of us wants to get a disease and then having to go to a hospital and be cured. Ideally, we would like to prevent, to predict the, you know, possibility of a disease and then prevent it by taking the right actions. And that's something that AI and a lot of what I've been doing over the past revolves around. So we can use historical information to predict the progression of a disease or, you know, the onset of a disease, and then provide information to the people that might be affected in the future by this disease on what to do to avoid that. And so that's fascinating to me because it changes completely the concept of medicine from curing disease and having to take medications, going to a hospital, seeing a clinician, to instead preventing that, so being healthy and avoiding that. That pretty much boils down also to the second one, which is the personalization component. So how can we improve the health of people with recommendations and tailored information, and do this in ways that it's effective, personalized, and takes into account all of their characteristics. But it's probably the third on paperwork, the one I'm most fascinated about, which is the fact that AI, especially ChatGPT, can reduce by a lot the time that doctors spend in hospital not dealing with patients, so dealing with admin tasks, with data entry in their, you know, EHR systems and so on. So try to cut down all of that time spent away from patients and putting the doctors close to a patient. That's definitely something that I find fascinating.
So let's drill into this a bit further. So you talked about AI being applied from a personalization, precision medicine standpoint, and it has this predictive capability, which can then help in prevention. And then, of course, it reduces the workflow, helps to improve the efficiency of the workflow and paperwork, as you mentioned, and so on. And then you talked about foundational models, of which large language models with fit within foundational models. And this is within the sort of broad scope of AI. And within AI, you have machine learning. And within machine learning, you have deep learning. And within those, you have large language models, which are foundational models. And there's other kinds. So there's kind of this hierarchy. And then you talked about ChatGPT, which that technology or GPT has been embedded into Microsoft products like Bing AI. In fact, that's how I found out more about CVC at CVS Health, was putting into Bing AI. And I thought, wow, this is pretty good. So I use it a lot. And then you've seen all the announcement from Microsoft Build come out later this month, where they're going to talk about all of the different kinds of integration they're doing with GPT technology. And so they fully embraced it. And but you saw Jeffrey Hinton come out this week and saying, you know what, I'm going to retire from Google. And he, you know, really is supportive of Google and what they're doing. But he says he's, and I got to be careful. So I recommend the audience go and search online so you get his direct voice. But my interpretation is, what he's saying is that he didn't realize it was going to be that fast. He thought that some of the things that you're seeing now are going to be, what, 30 or 50 years into the future. And then he realizes that this is progressing much faster. And that capability is much more profound than he had originally thought would happen this quickly. And so that's why he's now going out in public and so on. So I want to talk about what that means from an opportunity and positive standpoint. Do you think these generative pre-trained transformers, that's what GPT stands for, do you think these GPT-4 and similar kind of models that are out there, and of which Microsoft has embraced, do you believe that they will become much more AGI oriented, which I think Jeffrey Hinton, a really famous computer scientist, is alluding to? And then I'm thinking about some of the engineer, like the engineer last year from Google, who came out and said, oh my God, this thing is like has more capability, and he ended up leaving the company. And at that time, I remember really a lot of backlash, because people are saying this gentleman is way out there and this is an outlier thinking, it's not the mainstream. But now you see this sort of turn of the tide where people are thinking, no, there's a lot of and it's literally within a year. And literally when OpenAI released ChatGPT and people started using it. So what are your predictions on this? Do you think that there's this, like in one of the Microsoft papers, they said sparks of AGI, or do you think that that's where it's going? And even though it's not human intelligence, it's some kind of capability. And what does that mean for you? Because if you look online again, you see, I see a piece by Peter Lee, who's a VP of research at Microsoft. And it's a very well thought out piece, and I guess a book or some sort, and where they can see a lot of advantages. Of course, there's guardrails you need, and there's areas where it's deficient, but they can see where it can help in the medical area. So I like your thoughts on that, because you work with the largest health company in the world, you lead innovation, and you've worked with generative AI, so you have a pretty good on these foundational models, so you know what its capabilities are. So I'd like your deeper thoughts on this.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I gotta say, I think every person in AI has been very surprised about the speed at which AI has been going over the past year. And like Hinton, I also, when ChatGPT started, I basically told everyone, like, I would have never thought that would have changed so much, especially of the creative arts, you know, drawing, writing, and so on, in such a fast time, such a quick time. And I think that boils down to the fact that artificial intelligence has not been following a linear fashion, but rather an exponential fashion. And now I believe that we hit that inflection point, and we as humans are terrible in, you know, thinking in non-linear terms. And I think that's what we're seeing, all of these people, you know, quitting Google or having other, you know, conversations in general about we never expected this to go this fast. I would say it's probably boils down to the fact that we cannot think in non-linear terms. And so I think that something now is going so fast is mind-blowing. And I definitely think that, as Bill Gates said, we are now in the age of AI. You know, I'm a bit biased, of course, and I definitely think that we are approaching AGI faster than we thought we were going to. And this is at least my take. I know that talking about AGI is always a very difficult topic. It's always a very sensitive topic. But I don't think, of course, that we've reached AGI yet. But I feel that when a system almost feels like sometimes, or it might be tricking someone into thinking that it might have reached AGI, I would say that's really a pretty good indication that we're in the right path for that. I think that some of the interactions that I have with ChatGPT definitely sound human, definitely sound like I'm talking to someone who's an expert. And sometimes it's actually pretty scary, because when I ask it to write code or I give it feedback, it implements it sometimes better than humans as well. And we even saw some articles saying that ChatGPT and artificial intelligence was put against doctors in terms of, you know, empathy, accurateness of the responses to patients' questions. And we saw that AI was almost sometimes even better on the empathy side. So it's doing a great job in, you know, getting to that AGI point. And I think what's fascinating there, for me at least, it's not even anymore the technological component, you know, the deep learning neural network structure or how it actually works, but rather the societal implications. The fact that now everybody has access to these super powerful models and you can use them to create videos automatically. You can use them to create music. You can use them in so many different ways that we're going to see new avenues, new areas that we've never thought about before. And I think that's the most fascinating part is the fact that it's unlocking some areas that we thought would have not been unlocked for probably hundreds of years.
So have you tried, you must have, I guess. I mean, can you talk about the speed of papers coming out where, I mean, I've been in this thing for so long. I even embedded some sort of AI kind of capability in a system I wrote in 1986. So, and then you would look at these different papers coming out over the years, and maybe it's one major one every year, then maybe one every quarter or something. Can you talk about the nature of some of these papers coming out? And because of the role you have, you probably are sampling a lot of them. So that side. And then if you could talk about, have you played with AutoGPT? And we're still at the very beginning of it, what the implications are. So two parts of that question. The acceleration of papers coming out, which are really interesting. And then this AutoGPT and what that means, if you can define what it does, and then where you see that going, because we're just at its initial launch. And it seems to me 2 weeks ago when I looked up, I think it was GitHub, there's like over 100,000 or something like that, likes or whatever, like acknowledgements that this is something that's really interesting, right? So,
yeah, first of all, I've never seen a speed like the current one in terms of throughput of AI papers. And it's both amazing and also a bit scary sometimes, because I would say the beauty of all of this is that obviously we have so much research being thrown every single day out and we have so much to go through. But that at the same time is the issue, like people even like me, one of my biggest issues is how can I stay on top of all of this progress and be aware of all of the different types of models, that architectures, try at least and read maybe the abstract of each paper. It's not possible. We cannot become experts in all of these papers. But then it also begs a bit of a question of whether we are doing right in publishing so much so quickly. I'm not a big fan because I simply think it's not possible to stop the progress of artificial intelligence. But it sounds a bit like when in COVID, during COVID-19, we have so many papers about COVID-19 and machine learning models about COVID-19. I would say that to some extent, all of that work done so quickly might have hurt a bit the healthcare industry and our ability to react to that situation because of the amount of information it was impossible to go through and many conflicting thoughts, many different opinions. And so to some extent, I'm very excited about the new amount of papers and the speed at which they're being generated. But at the same time, I'm also a bit cautious because we really need to understand better all of these algorithms. And to answer the second part of the question, I've not actually played with AutoGPT yet. I think I'll do today. It sounds like it's the right thing to do, but I've seen a lot of people publishing and writing about it. And to me, it's the fascinating thing about all of this and why I was saying before that we're now in the age of AI. It's the fact that we have these tools that are so capable, so good, that we can unlock all of these different areas. We can have not just a chatbot, not just a tool to very well converse with, but we actually can have systems that do tasks for us. They even now generate videos, generate music, but also some people have created some sort of ecosystem, with artificial intelligence entities that create their own society. And so I feel that definitely we're not in the at the AGI level, but we're approaching very much to it. It's very, very close.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the thing about Auto GPT, I mean, it's a open source, or you can put it into your machine. I mean, into your computer, you can start playing with it. And there's even free sites where you can have a sandbox and try it. Of course, if it consumes too many compute cycles, then you have to get an open AI license or something like that. But and I think one of them is what Agent GPT, something like that. There's these free ones. Again, the audience can just do a search in Bing AI and look at what are some of the free sites on Auto GPT, and then how can you? There's even YouTube videos on how to download it and install it, and then play with it and so on. I ran it about 2 weeks ago, and I was surprised what it does. I was thinking, I went, wow. Because it self-prompts. Like normally when you work with a GPT, you're doing you're it's like you're generating the prompts to guide it. This thing prompts itself. You give it goals and it prompts itself to solve your goals. Unless it runs out of compute, then it says, oh, you should go and get a license from OpenAI and then you can continue this journey. But then I'm thinking, oh my God, it could run up a bill. whereas you work with a large company, so they could absorb that as you play with it. But maybe there's a scary side too, right? Because it can write code and then refine it on its own.
That's what I think it's fascinating, is that it can create its own code, it can create its own, system itself. Like, we can have AI creating AI, and we've seen that it can create code better than us to some extent. And so I'm fascinated about the things that it can do. And as you said, if it can prompt itself, it can just work towards a goal. Like, that's a whole new concept. That's also something. I can even create them, new algorithms, even better ones, and come up with creative ideas. So it's reshaping not just, creative arts, like journalism and so on. It's reshaping everything, basically.
Have you played with the Hugging Face program or Hugging Face community at all, or?
Yeah, a bit of with that as well too, and especially with DALL-E 2 and all of the image generation tools as well. I think those are also game changers.
So maybe you can describe to the audiences what is Hugging Face, and then what does that mean?
Yeah,
So.
it's a company providing pretty much, or at least trying to provide open source software that's about artificial intelligence and machine learning. So it's trying to build a community and ecosystem of machine learning tools, platforms, and resources. And so I would say probably that's also one of the reasons why we're having such a huge progress, because we have had these amazing changes, in AI. But at the same time, there are a lot of parties that are trying to foster the open source, or open sourcing code, but also data at the same time. And that's showing amazing results, because we can then build on top of each other. I'm a big fan of open source software and data. I think one of the things that Hugging Face is also doing very well is understanding the ability also to capitalize on open source. It might sometimes seem as a good way to lose money, to not be a real business, but it's actually having a lot of different benefits, and they are capitalizing a lot on that.
Yeah, and then you can build a GPT system that automatically calls the different tools that are specialized, right? So, I mean, it's just quite remarkable where this is going, and I can see why. I mean, I saw Geoffrey Hinton come out maybe, I don't know, a month ago, and he did this interview with CBS, and if you went on YouTube, there was a much deeper 40 something minutes, and it was very thoughtful discussion. I recommend the audience look at it because it's not it's not alarmist in alarmist kind of existential way, but it's a very thoughtful discussion of where it's going and the implications of it, right? And then you can see him talking more about that lately, so. Really interesting. Okay, so we've explored that generative AI and the foundation models to a certain extent, and you clearly it's going to have an impact in medicine and the medical field and the clinical side and so on. Are there any other transformational areas that you think are interesting because you're in healthcare? And I'll seed that question, for example, if you look at Yamanaka and then he's now an advisor to a company that's it's reported that Jeff Bezos is a is an investor in this company, and it has to do with aging. And I believe if you look at some of the media indicating that it had the most sort of seed funding of any startup, or one of the most funded of any startup. And then you have David Sinclair and his work on the aging side. Are you following any of that work on biomedical innovation? And then there's other aspects of biomedical innovation. For example, Philip Wong has the ability to insert these microchips that are a fraction of the size of a cell, and it can sense, it can act as a sensor. You can use these chips for monitoring and also influence the behavior of cells. Or if you look at the work at Teriyaki Institute, they've got these microfluidic kind of technologies, other biomedical innovation technologies, and so on. Are you following any of that? And do you have any comment on that or things that you think are really exciting?
Bit of that, yeah. I find everything is related to kind of like the human genomics, all of the biomedical engineering areas too. I studied biomedical engineering at Imperial College, and I think that everything is about human augmentation and enhancing the human condition, not just through AI. It's fantastic, it's fascinating, it's the way to go. But again, we are seeing so many tools so quickly that have a huge potential also. Possible drawbacks. I'm thinking like CRISPR and all of these technologies. And those obviously are tools that can show you, like AI, a lot of benefits, but also a lot of the possible issues. And every time that we deal with people, every time that we deal with humans in the loop, it's a bit of a challenge because we can be extremely powerful. We can do a lot for better or for worse. And what is actually fascinating to me is seeing how AI can help in all these different areas. And so we've seen also with DeepMind AI helping in coming up with new protein structures for drugs, for solutions. But I would say that was before the generative AI, the large language models. So I'm fascinated now to even see the intersection of AI and biomedical engineering and all of these new endeavors, because I think that AI can definitely come up with new solutions with new ways and also solve a lot of the problems. There might be AutoGPT type of solutions that query themselves and prompt themselves to try and find solutions to some of the big problems of biomedical engineering. And that's probably one of the fascinating things with AI. It's horizontal and it can apply to virtually any industry, any area.
You talk about DeepMind and AlphaFold 2, where they open source, they actually release the protein structures of hundreds of millions of proteins, right? And this is sometimes called the dark matter of proteins because people didn't even know they existed. So, and typically in a lab or to do this kind of structure could take a year, 2 years, something like that. They did all of it, right? So, pretty much, and then they released it, making it available to everybody. I mean, humans just couldn't even do that. It's just not even possible, right? So
It's fascinating. It's unlocking new potential. And I think that's probably one of the issues right now is that we can do so much. We have so many options, opportunities, almost in some sort of analysis paralysis, whatever. There's so much we can do, so many different things, but we almost get sometimes a bit crushed by all of the different ways we can use AI to change all the things we're doing.
but you're at the perfect spot. I mean, are you investigating quantum computing too? Because a lot of the health phenomena is nature, right? And quantum computing, quantum computers very much align with anything that's sort of nature-based, right? It's a perfect combination, providing they can get, you know, the better coherence and manage noise better and things like that. And there's a lot of work, a lot of money going into this. So it used to be maybe 10 years ago, people used to think quantum computing, that's 2100 or 2050. They don't. The majority of the people I talk to don't think that anymore. They think it's in the near term, you know, 2035, maybe even before 2030, and niche applications already now, and more so by 2025. That's when I talk to quantum computing people. So are you looking at it because it's going to have an impact on health, right?
Yeah, definitely something that I'm in no way an expert, but I think it's something to definitely keep an eye on, and it's going to be another huge innovation in the world. I think it's fascinating to see how the world is going in this direction of having, at the same time, all of these, you know, once in a lifetime, almost innovations. So you have AI, quantum computing, CRISPR, and so on. I'd say that's one of the reasons I'm so hopeful and optimistic, at least on the potential of technology for the next hundreds of years or so. Is the fact that you can have something as powerful as quantum computing providing even more computational power to all of these technologies, including AI. So you can have quantum computing running AI systems. And I don't even know how powerful this AI system can be with all of that power stored from quantum computing. And obviously, it doesn't apply only to AI, it applies to everything. But it's fascinating to see this new sort of technological revolution or industrial revolution, thanks to all of these key components that are the right ones at the right time.
Yeah, we live in an unusual time because of this escalation of exponential transformational tech, but it's exponential. It's not just exponential, it's just like onto itself, right? So And you're leading a lot of this, right, due to your work. So what will life look like in 2030?
If there's one thing I learned, is not to make predictions anymore, because clearly I'm wrong. I'm not able to keep the pace of progress. But I would say definitely AI is going to become much more of an integral part of our lives, for better or for worse. So I definitely think that that's the way we're going. Yeah, it's not going to become anymore entity in itself. It's more going to be a feature. Everything is going to have some sort of AI in it, which is why it's fascinating to be in that area, because I think it can apply to horizontally every different sector. And that's also one of the reasons why I'm very interested in the data component, is that I hope that by 2030, we're going to have a much better data structure, because at the end of the day, that's the fuel that all of the AI needs. So I definitely think that by 2030, we're going to have AI in every system, in every tool. But I also hope that we're going to have a better data infrastructure, not just for healthcare, but for anything. Because if we can unlock that power, then we can really have huge benefits.
So what role will synthetic data play in this?
I'm honestly not a huge fan of synthetic data, just because I find it a great technical solution, but not so much of a great real life, true people solution, in the sense that usually synthetic data is generated by just that small amount of data that we have. So it tends to perpetrate all of the biases, continue all of the biases, all of the discriminations that we have. If we have in healthcare data a small population and we expand that, we create synthetic data based on that, it's usually a situation where we're tricking a system, an algorithm, to thinking that that's everything we have, everything we can possibly have. It might be not even considering some minorities, some other areas. So definitely, I would say it's a solution, it's a possible solution, but I think there is a lot of way to go before we can use it well, I would say, especially in an ethical way.
That's interesting. And are you working on the ethical sort of principle side and then operationalizing that, sort of embedding that in your work? And then, you know, what if you are, then what communities would you recommend to, for people out there in the audience? I mean, I often recommend Microsoft because Microsoft has a very mature, responsible AI program. Operationalizing, and that means making practical ways that you can do AI in a responsible way. They even have material for executives who are considering embedding AI into their companies. There's UNESCO and others. Are you embedded in some of that work as well, or plan to be?
Yeah, that's definitely one of my key areas of focus right now is the ethics of AI. I've often a lot of conversation with also professors across the world about, you know, the principles, but also how can we bring this to practice? And I'd say that's the biggest issue. So right now we have such powerful tools. It's not anymore about how can we make them better? How can we make that accuracy or that AUC score better? It's more about how can we ensure that we're treating people fairly, we're not, you know, perpetrating biases and so on. And so the ethics of AI is especially important now when we have a strange situation with a lot of power in AI systems, but also at the same time, a lot of lack of regulation. As we definitely have to go in that direction. But I would say the most challenging point right now of ethics is the fact that people tend to focus on high level principles, which are great, but everybody agrees on them. Everybody agrees on, you know, not perpetrating bias, not, you know, perpetrating discriminations and so on. It's more of a matter that data is by definition biased. It will always be. It's more about finding pragmatic ways to eliminate this bias, or at least reduce it. And as you said, Microsoft is a great tool. I would say also IBM's AI Fairness 360 ecosystem is a great one to ensure fairness in systems. And that's what I'm trying to focus on right now, is looking online all the possible ways we can do fairness and ethics and so on, but not through principles, but through actual tools and best practices, and codify them so that every data scientist can do what they would like to do. So actually ensure ethics in the systems.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I just did a fireside for a company called Avanade. I was the only speaker. So they asked me for a keynote, and I said, well, why don't we just do a chat? So I didn't ask me anything. And it was really amazing because you had this broad spectrum in the audience. You had scientists and engineers and executives and project managers. And Avanade is a tech company, right? It's probably the world's largest Microsoft IT shop services company, but it's a joint venture between Accenture, which is what, the number one or one of the largest services companies, and then Microsoft, which is the largest, is broad tech company. And this question came up as well. So, and you know, how do you make it practical? So it's, there's a difference between having frameworks and principles and then actually using it. So I actually mentioned an institute called the Responsible AI Institute. It's a nonprofit. It's supported by the Canadian government, and now the US, different parts of the US government supporting, I believe the UK government and so on. They've created tools, and they've created a certification system as well. So maybe, I don't know if you've looked at their work, but it's very, very practical. It's meant to be practical, right?
Yeah, I've heard about them. I've not looked too much at that work, but I'll definitely do. I think that's exactly what we have to do, is going from principles to pragmatic ways. You know, right. I see data scientists like in my team and even in the past, they want to do this. Like, they want to make sure that their systems are correct. It just says there is no unanimous decision on what should be done to address bias and to remove it, take care of it, and so on.
Yeah, in fact, Ashley Cassavan, who founded this group, she ran the data program for Canada. And Canada was the first country to come out with a data, a policy program. And their legislation they're working on this area is world leading as well. And then she formed this Responsible AI Institute. But she's a member of every major group that you can think of, whether it's UNESCO or the World Economic Forum, OECD, ISO, IEEE. I mean, she's got her, you know, her capabilities in all of those different programs. And then what she and her team did is try to harmonize it, right? So, you know, taking the best of what's out there and saying, okay, how can we make it practical? So I think it's really interesting what she is doing. But, you know, what you're doing is really interesting as well. So we're down to our last question. You've done so much. You won all these awards. You created this system with your team to help the U.S. when you were in this COVID situation. You're leading innovation within this amazing company, and you're really interested in having sort of a social impact in a positive way, truly sort of AI for good, for good purposes. What final recommendations do you want to leave to the audience?
I would say definitely to try and find their, you know, why, so to say. And as you said, mine is definitely to try to have a positive impact on society, basically improve a human condition through AI and all of these advanced technologies, and not the other way around. And so definitely to try and find kind of like better calling, better vocation, better why, and then to try only after to use all of these technologies like ChatGPT and so on to try and achieve that mission. And usually that's best ways, like when we create a startup, you know, we have to solve a real problem. We have to help people. We have to understand their issues and only after create a technology solution. So definitely that's what's been motivating me so far and what will be also in the future. So try to be good and try to use AI and all of these technologies to do so. And I definitely recommend this to everyone.
Yeah, and in fact, I you know, those are great recommendations. And I work with a lot of CEOs and investors. So we try to frame this in this language. We say purposeful leadership, purposeful innovation, purposeful business, purposeful capital and investments, but really purposeful. And then all of these other words associated with it. So you're doing it in with the mind of for the benefit of humanity and all of Earth ecosystems. So really for tech for good, or leadership for good, or and so on. And you definitely are the epitome of that. So yeah, Eugenio, thank you for coming in and sharing so much of your insights with our audience.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to chat about all of these amazing topics.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.